Right. Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews chapter 9. And we are, remember chapter 7, 8, and 9? Talk about how much greater Christ is as our high priest. And chapter 7 stressed that he was in some way like Melchizedek. And we talked about that in chapter 7. Chapter 8, we talked about how Jesus as a high priest, his service for us is so much greater than the high priest of the Old Testament. And now in chapter 9, the writer emphasizes the tabernacle. Because at this time, remember, there was nothing in the temple in Jerusalem. The most holy place was empty. All of that had been taken by the Philistines or by other groups. So there was actually nothing in the most holy place at this time for the Jewish high priest to be doing. So for the Jewish people who were still observing the law of Moses, their day of atonement could not be like it used to be. All right. Of course, this is Herod's temple, and it's still being built. Even though there's nothing in the most holy place, Herod is still building that temple. Remember, the first temple, Solomon's temple, had been destroyed. The next temple was sorry compared to the first one. And when they were building the second temple, remember in some of the books of prophecy, they talked about how substandard the new temple was. It just wasn't like Solomon's temple. And then Herod's temple, like I said, there's not even anything in the most holy place. It's just empty. So I think that's why the writer here goes back and talks about what it looked like in the tabernacle, the very early days of the law of Moses, when it was a temporary place. In other words, they moved it, they would carry it, they would set it up, they would stay at a certain place, tear it down, move it. All right. So he talks about what was in the tabernacle, in both the holy place and the most holy place, and then he starts making a comparison in chapter 9 between the holy place, which is like the church today, and the most holy place, which is like heaven, and how Jesus led the way into heaven when he was resurrected and then ascended into heaven. And that's pretty much what we talked about last Sunday morning. And then we come down to about verse 11 in Hebrews chapter 9. It says, "But Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, with a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation." Over and over in these last three chapters, he's talked about how Jesus, his work is of a spiritual nature, whereas a lot of the work of the priest of the Old Testament was more physical. And he even mentions that here. Jesus is high priest of the good things to come. And of course, Jesus built his church, and we know it came into existence there in Acts chapter 2 on Pentecost. Then he is said to have led the way into heaven. He opened it up when he ascended. And his is the greater and more perfect tabernacle. It's not like the old tabernacle. The old tabernacle that we go back and read about in Exodus and Leviticus, you know, it had physical curtains, and it had physical wood and physical gold and physical bronze. They were all, and it stressed these physical outward objects and processes and rituals, whereas what Jesus has done emphasizes a more spiritual nature. And that's why he says it's not made with hands. It's not of this creation. It's not, we don't have a physical ark. We don't have a physical laver. We don't have a physical candlestick. We don't have a physical altar. It is all spiritual in nature. You know, in the days when the tabernacle and the temple were in existence, they represented where God was. Okay, the ark, remember it had the mercy seat on top of it with the two angels facing each other. That ark and the mercy seat on top of it represented God's presence. Well, now, again, that was all physical. Well, today, in our world, in our Christian age, we don't have a physical ark like that. You know, our pews aren't holy, this table isn't holy, the pulpit isn't holy. None of that is holy in any sense. God hasn't sanctified those things like he did all the things in the tabernacle and the temple. It's much more of a spiritual nature. And so he says, it's not with the blood of goats and calves, verse 12, but with his own blood, he entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. And that's one of the key verses in the whole book. It's really one of the key verses. Because the blood of goats and calves and bulls and all that blood was able to do was temporarily, relieve them of that guilt. But then it was remembered every year over and over again on the Day of Atonement. Over and over and over again it was remembered. So the blood of animals didn't have the power that Jesus' blood did. That's why it had to be offered over and over and over again. Every day, every year. Over and over, because it didn't have the power that Christ's blood had. Christ, he says, he did not take the blood of goats and calves, but he took his own blood, it says, his own blood. And he entered the most holy place. He entered heaven once for all time. See, in the days of the law of Moses, every year the high priest had to go into the most holy place. Every year it was repeated over and over and over for like 1600 years. They did that over and over again. So 1600 times the high priest, whoever was high priest that year, would go into the most holy place. So it only had the power, if you will, to last for a year. Then it had to be repeated. Then another 12 months, repeated again. Another 12 months, repeated again. Not so with Jesus. Only took one time. One sacrifice, one time, he says, was all it took. Because he did it once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. That's all it took. Because this same letter says that that power of his blood went back and took care of all of the sins going back to the time of Adam and Eve. All of them. That's how powerful his blood is and was. Because it obtained, he said, eternal redemption. Of course, that blood, that redemption, he says, was conditional. Was conditional. We read about that in Hebrews chapter 5, verse 9. He's the author of eternal salvation to all those who obey him. So while his blood was shed and made redemption possible for everyone from Adam and Eve on, it's only going to have power for those who obey him. So those are the ones, he says, that will be freed from sin, forgiven, redeemed, over and over. And he says, all it took was one single time. Now, when you think about the trillions and trillions of sins that's been committed by mankind since Adam and Eve, that's some powerful blood. Trillions of sins. Because during the law of Moses, you would have to sacrifice a lamb for one sin. Just one single sin. A lamb or a bull or whatever. A single sin. But Jesus' blood and sacrifice took care of trillions and trillions, or maybe even more, sins. That's why I said verse 12 is such a key verse, well, really, in the entire Bible. Because it sums up so much about what salvation is all about. He says, "For if the blood of goats or bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling the unclean, sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" Blood of bulls and goats, ashes of a heifer. Remember, there were so many different things that they had to do during the time of the law of Moses, the sacrifices, the sprinkling, the blood. Remember, the high priest had to do that too, and he would have to sprinkle the blood, and it was usually mixed a lot of times with ashes. And so there were so many things that had to be done for this purifying to take place. And even when it took place, it only lasted a year. Then it had to be repeated. Another 365 days, had to repeat it. Another 365 days, repeat it again. So, you know, if you lived 50 years, then you saw that happen 50 times. So every year it had to be repeated. So it never had the power, as he says, to cleanse a person's conscience. It couldn't take away the guilt of sin. See, that's what the blood of bulls and goats could not do. It could not take away the guilt of a person's sin because he was reminded, he or she was reminded of it every year. So today, Christ's sacrifice can completely rid us of any guilt. Once that sin is forgiven, whatever the sin is, there is no more guilt associated with it. It's completely gone. You did not have that prior to the death of Christ. You didn't have it, he says. It's only through his death that that was made possible. So, again, emphasizes how powerful and necessary Christ's death was. So going on to verse 14. He says, "How much more," again there's the comparison, "those animals under the Old Testament did not have that kind of power." Another big difference between those was the animals that were sacrificed with blood or bulls or lambs or whatever it was, those were not voluntary sacrifices. In other words, they were picked out of the flock. They picked the very best ones they could find, the ones without spot and blemish, and they were killed. Christ said that his sacrifice was totally voluntary. Let's go to John chapter 10. This is a big, big difference between Christ as our high priest and his sacrifice and the ones of years ago. John 10, verse 17 and 18, if somebody would read those. John chapter 10, verses 17 and 18.
"Therefore does my Father love me, because I lay down my life that I might take it again. No man taketh it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. This commandment have I received of my Father."
See? No one takes it from him. Nobody forced him to do it. He says, "I laid down my life myself." You know, I chose to do it. I volunteered to do it. Well, none of the sacrifices in the Old Testament were voluntary. They were all forced. His was completely voluntary. Huge difference between those sacrifices and his sacrifices. And his, like that verse said, was he was offered without spot. He was a perfect, you know, they would always try and find, especially on the Day of Atonement when he sacrificed the bull, one that was as perfect as they could find. No spot, no blemish. But there weren't any perfect ones. Whereas he didn't have the slightest sin, spot, blemish of any kind. His was completely without spot. So repeatedly in chapter 7, 8, and 9, the writer just emphasizes over and over again, in every way, how much better Christ is as our high priest, as our sacrifice, as our Savior. He's better in every possible way. Every possible way. There was nothing in him that was a spot of any kind. And he says, this is able to cleanse our conscience from dead works. Once we have been forgiven, truly forgiven, like God says we can be, there is not any guilt left. It's not going to be remembered a year from now. It's not ever going to be remembered by God, period. It's completely gone. There is no reason to have any guilt over it once it's truly forgiven. And that, again, shows how much better we are than they were. So there's no reason to fear that God is going to bring up someday something that we were forgiven for. No. That guilt is gone, and he says it's gone forever. So remember, from the very beginning of this book, he has emphasized how Christ is better than the angels, Hebrews chapter 1. And through all the way here, everything about Christ is better, is superior. His covenant, his sacrifice, his blood, his high priesthood, over and over and over again. So we can have a conscience free of guilt. And a conscience here is one, of course, that's focused on and trained by God's Word. And then verse 15, and for this reason, just what he's just talked about, and for this reason he's the mediator of the new covenant, because he offered himself, he shed his blood, he entered the most holy place, he's entered into heaven. Because of that, he's the mediator, he's the go-between of the new covenant by means of death. We'll talk about what that means here in just a second, but that has some importance as well. For the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, that those who are called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. So, the benefits, the blessings of his blood, he says, flowed all the way back. All the way back. Because those people couldn't have a guilt-free life. But because of what Christ did, now everybody, he says, can be redeemed for the redemption of the transgressions. See, those people were not completely redeemed, but Christ's blood made it possible. As he says, those who are called may receive that promise. So he is the mediator because he died, shed his blood, rose from the dead, entered heaven, and he's the mediator of that new covenant. And he says, because this goes right along with it, these next two verses. For where there is a testament, or where there is a covenant, where there is a will, there must also of necessity be the death of the testator. For a testament is in force after men are dead, since it has no power at all while the testator lives. A will comes in force after the person dies. It has no power before. If John Doe has left somebody X amount of money in his will, then that person gets that money after he dies. While before he dies, he can change the will if he wants to. He can do whatever he wants to because it's his will. It's Christ's testament. It is Christ's will. It's his covenant. He could have done anything he wanted. But once he died, it was all permanently set. It was all permanently set. That's why Christ on the cross could tell the thief on the cross, today you'll be with me in paradise. Jesus hadn't died yet. He could do whatever he wanted. But after he died, his will was set in place. His will was set in place. But before, like I said, he could do whatever he wanted. It was his will. He had the power to forgive sins. He had the power to save. And though it says there has to be the death. So when he died, then his will, his testament, his covenant went into play, went into power. And he says it's in force after men are dead, since it has no power at all while the testator lives. It only comes into play, it only, like he says, has power after that testator, that person, whosever will it is, passes. So, very important for us to understand about Christ's will, his testament, his covenant. He is the one that had the power to put the conditions in the will. Like I said, he could have put whatever conditions in the will he wanted. Because it's his will. It's not my will. I don't have the power to change somebody else's will. It's not my will. It was their will. And so Christ's will, nobody had the power to change it but him. And then once he died, nobody, period, could change it. No committee could change it. No pope can change it. Nobody can change anything. It's his will. It's set. Nobody can change the tiniest part of it. It's completely finished. There's nothing anybody can do to change his will. Once he dies, whatever those conditions are set. In other words, that will has to stand just like it is written. We'll talk about that later. So, that's probably a good place to stop. Because then I want to talk all the way down to verse 22 is kind of one idea. But the idea of a will and Jesus being the testator of the will and his death being necessary is a very, very important part of the book of Hebrews. The writer makes that very clear. So, well, thank you very much for being here. And Lord willing, we'll start with verse 18 next Sunday morning.